Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Today's going to be fun. Today's broadcast is a conversation between myself and three of the four hosts of the Secular Jihadists from the Middle East broadcast. I'm going to have Ali Rizvi, Armin Nababi, Yasmin Muhammad joining me on the radio. We're going to talk a little bit about the holiday. We're going to talk about Islam and just whatever else happens to come up. They are a lot of fun. They're dear friends, and I'm honored that they're going to be a part of the broadcast today. There is a video version of this podcast, so if you'd like to watch the exchange instead of merely listening, you can find the video, the YouTube link, in the description box. Next week, the entire broadcast is going to be a monologue about the Nativity. Not from the perspective of God, or the baby Jesus, or the Virgin Mary, but from the perspective of a character that we just don't hear very much about. We're going to hear from Joseph. Have you noticed this? I mean, Joseph is always kind of an afterthought. I mean, he's always there as part of the story. He's involved. But the focus is almost always on somebody else. Well, not anymore, my friends. Next week, the previously unsung Joseph will get his moment in the spotlight with kind of a one-man radio play that is almost certainly unlike any nativity story you have ever heard before. It was fun to write. It's going to be fun to perform for you next week. In the show, I actually ask, you know, why doesn't the New Testament have a book of Joseph? He's the stepfather of God. He doesn't get his own book. Beyond that, even, I am genuinely fascinated by the early works of Christianity. You know, those verses and those stories and those Bible books that didn't make the official canon and become part of the Bible that we recognize today. There's a lot of that material out there that's not part of the 66 books of the Bible. Dr. Bart Ehrman has got a ton of fascinating information about the early scriptures, the often unknown and uncanonized books like the Book of Thomas, the Epistle of Barnabas, the Apocryphal Acts. There are thousands of early New Testament writings, often hand-copied, wildly contradictory, and not part of the Bible that you and I know. Witness Christianity's Untold and Unsung Scriptures with Dr. Bart Ehrman's fascinating lecture called Lost Christianities, Christian Scriptures, and the Battles Over Authentication. Right now, I can get you 30 days, a full month of free and full access to the entire lecture series at The Great Courses Plus, along with all of the over 8,500 other lectures that you can stream or download to any TV, any computer, laptop, or smartphone. You can listen like a podcast on their app. Subjects range from religions to history to chemistry to health and nutrition to the arts to food and wine. It's an opportunity you do not want to pass up, and information you can use in your own discussions about Jesus studies, about religion, history, and beyond. Again, The Great Courses Plus, giving my listeners an entire month of unlimited access to all of their lectures for free, but you have to sign up with my special URL. So get started today. You will love it. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Joining me for the secular jihadist version of the Thinking Atheist podcast is Ali Rizvi. Great to have you, my friend.
Hi, Seth. Good to talk to you again. It's always a pleasure.
Yasmin Muhammad joins us as well. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much for inviting us, Seth.
And Armin Nababi of Atheist Republic, as always, it is a pleasure, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to start with you, Armin Nababi of Atheist Republic. What does Islam think about Jesus? Like, I always see him listed as one of the prophets, but from what I can see on the outside, it doesn't look like Jesus is really all that to, you know, the devout What's Islam's take on Jesus?
So according to Islam, Jesus was a prophet of God, and actually he was a Muslim, because all religions of true prophets of God, Islam, it's just like a lighter version of Islam, because Muhammad is the final prophet and he brings Islam in the full version. And basically what the Christian, the Bible that we have today, and the Christian version of what Jesus's life and what Jesus has taught is completely changed and misrepresented by, according to Islam, by Christians, right? And if you actually had access to the true teachings of Jesus, you would see that there is not much contradiction with Muhammad's teaching. Not only that, one of the main areas of focus when it comes to Jesus's life that Muslims try to point to is that Jesus actually never died on a cross. When the Romans and the Jews went to find Jesus, God made somebody, the person that betrayed Jesus, look like Jesus. And therefore the Romans went and crucified that person by mistake. And actually Jesus never died.
So the one who betrayed Jesus looked like Jesus.
God turned his face to look like Jesus. So they crucified him by mistake and Jesus got away.
So this wouldn't be Judas, but it would be the equivalent of Judas.
Yeah. Right. It was a decoy. God basically put a decoy in his place.
Right.
I don't read this in the four Gospels, my friends. I don't see this in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Where do you get this blasphemy from? Where does it come from?
Well, this is what we all learn in Islamic school. I think it's Hadith, right? But this is what it has been consistent among all Islamic school of thought, I think. I think this is also something that both Shias and Sunnis agree on.
Your information is blasphemous, Seth. This information is correct.
Right, this is the correct information.
This is
one thing that Sunnis and Shias agree on. So I think it's pretty much, if Sunnis and Shias can agree on something, that means it must be correct.
I was trying to think about, like, you know, the Muslim Christmas tree and just a little Muhammad on the top. You don't have the angel. And I thought, no, you can't do that.
On a Barak. You
can't do Muhammad.
The Barak
can't
is the flying horse. Yeah, not that Barak.
Oh, Ali or Yasmin, any thoughts on Christmas, Jesus, any of that stuff?
Well, I remember being a kid growing up here in Canada, and kids would be telling me about Santa brought them this and that, and what did Santa bring you? And I'd be like, nothing. So that was always very sad. Santa's supposed to love everybody and give everybody gifts.
What is your holiday then? Like, what was your Christmas?
Our Christmas is Eid, which is super boring. Like, we have.
I'm sorry, I lost you. Once again, what is it?
It's called Eid. And we slaughter an animal and eat it.
Well, there are two Eids, right?
There's two Eids. So there's one Eid that comes right after Ramadan, which you're celebrating being able to eat again, basically, because for the 30 days, you can't eat from sunrise to sunset. And then the other Eid, I mean, when I say celebrate, what do you celebrate? You get together and you pray and then you eat. And the exciting things are you get new clothes and some family members give you money. That's it. That's the whole holiday. Well, so there's it's not nearly as fun as all of the holidays in North America that you're watching all the other kids enjoy, right? Like Halloween and Christmas and Easter. Like,
hey, come on, kids. We're going to slaughter the animal. Everybody get together in the living room. We miss that part. Yeah. Allie, are you going to jump in there, or was it, I was listening to in the other end here.
Yeah. Sorry. Armin, you want to?
No, you go ahead. I'm going to add.
Yeah, no, I was going to add a couple more things to it. So the idea, as Armin said, there was a decoy that was sent, and the decoy was crucified. And then after that, Jesus was lifted up to heaven, where he remains to this day. He's still alive. He's in a state of, he's not dead. And then he is going to come back at the end of the world. So Jesus, the Muslim, the Islamic belief, and it varies. This part actually does vary between different sects. But the idea is that at some point he's going to come back. And some people say that he will be the Mahdi, which is the Messiah that's going to come back and save the world. Other people believe that he will be separate and he's going to come a little earlier. There is, the whole second coming aspect is somewhat, to some extent, consistent with with Christianity, except Jesus himself never died. He was lifted up to heaven and a decoy was killed in his place.
The difference, here's where Sunnis and Shias start to disagree, because Shias believe that when he comes back, he's going to come back with the 12 Imam. So Imam Mahdi, which is the 12 Imam that Shias believe in, when he comes back to make all of the world Muslim, Jesus will be right behind him on a horse, fighting the infidels, fighting us, basically, alongside Imam Mahdi, killing non-Muslims.
Why not a hoverboard? I mean, just...
Like what, yeah, in whatever century, whatever futuristic time frame it happens to be, why make it look like it's the first century? I don't get
it. Because they didn't
either.
Think it's going to take that long. They thought it was going to happen soon.
Still waiting.
We are obviously going to have to address the name of the group. Minus One, by the way, Faisal Saeed Al-Muhtar. Every time I schedule or we have an interview session, he's always busy.
He actually just started a new organization called Ideas Beyond Borders, and they're in full swing. They've got a college campus program going. They have a whole bunch of different projects on the go. So he is pretty much traveling all over the U.S. He's on a plane every other day. So he's been pretty busy setting that up. And so that's why.
He's blowing us off too, Seth. It's not personal.
Yeah, we all feel rejected.
Yeah, I figured he saw that my name is on the daytime. I ran into him in New York. And one thing about Faisal is he has this dry sense of humor, just dry, like the desert sense of humor, which he uses online to great effect as well. And so it's always fun to have him on the radio for that reason, or here on a video podcast. But we shall press on without him. The title of your podcast is Secular Jihadists from the Middle East. How much hate and death do you get from, I mean, I don't know, from the people who would be offended by such a title? Do you get this sort of correspondence, and what's it say, and how do you react?
Well, jihad, we just throw their line back at them. Jihad just means to struggle. So this is a secular struggle. We seculars, yeah. So basically what they say, when we say, oh, jihad, Islamic jihad, and there's so much jihad in the Quran, and it's very violent religion, what they come back to us and say is jihad, you know, there's two kinds of jihad. There's jihad against temptation, and then there's jihad against the infidels, which is the and the jihad against temptation, which is the inner jihad, because jihad by itself just means the struggle, right? Is basically the more important one. But what they don't mention is that if you read the Quran, the references to jihad are mostly the one that is about killing other people, killing non-Muslims, killing the
overwhelmingly.
Overwhelmingly, right. But I mean, for us, it was just a funny title, I guess, because I wanted to call it the atheist jihadist, but people were like, no, we need to be more inclusive. So I agree with you, like a secular jihadist. But overall, I think it's kind of funny, because it's kind of, people see it as a contradiction, kind of basically like Ali's book title, right? People are like, what the fuck? And basically, and it brings more attention to it, which is,
Yeah.
Ali Rizvi, you guys have a lot of jihad, or had a lot of jihad when you were in the Muslim faith. Did you feel that way about the rest of the world? That we must conquer the infidel? I mean, was that your stick or what?
So we all had different experiences. This is the interesting thing about being about the Muslim experience, is that even though Islam itself is pretty monolithic, there's one book, and you know, everybody believes in the same book. The Muslim experience, if you talk to Yaz and her experience with, you know, being married into Al-Qaeda, it's a far cry from the kind of experience that I had. My parents were university professors. They were Western educated. They weren't that angry at the U.S., except for, you know, maybe certain aspects of its foreign policy, particularly the fact that the U.S. was supporting the Mujahideen in the 80s. And Mujahideen, again, means people.
But whether you personally were going to pick up a gun or a sword and get involved in jihad, if you're a Muslim, you are understanding and agreeing to the fact that that's what the aim is. That's the goal of the religion. So we all sort of agree to those terms and conditions, but we're not all necessarily going to act on them.
like in my case, because we were the sort of hippy dippy Muslims, like the sort of more progressive Muslim in identity. So the only thing that we were taught about Islam, my parents had never really read the Quran or anything. They were just like, we're Muslim. That means, you know, you pray and then you do good things and you don't hurt other people. That's basically what they told us. And then it was only when I read the Quran later what Islam means. And it actually shocked them too when I went up to them and asked them questions. So that was also, but yeah, jihad, as we used to commemorate the jihad of Hussein, who was the Muhammad, and he went in Karbala, and there was just a city in Iraq. He sacrificed his entire family in the name of the faith. So that jihad was glamorized and celebrated. Martyrdom was definitely those in concept, but we knew that if we decided to go and join the jihad, our parents would. So that's the kind of background that I was in, but that is not extreme experience. That is a privileged Muslim experience.
Well, in Iran, we are told that we not in my home, but in our school, we are told that we should all be ready to go to war at any time, and we even have school. We have courses on how to fight. We have to, every single kid in school has to learn how to use the Kalashnikov and the G3, and basically the whole idea, we go over tactics and what. We actually had soldiers coming to our school and giving us lessons, and this is part of the, you know, public school curriculum. Every student has to go through this, and basically the understanding is that if Iran all of a sudden goes into an all-out war, every boy at a certain age has to answer the call. And I mean, even in Iran is right now actively trying to spread its territory. Even in Iraq, when we had the Iran-Iraq war, the whole idea was not to stop. The idea was to keep on invading until they captured the entire Islamic world. I mean, if you look at the Iranians,
until they capture the whole world and make it Islamic, you mean?
Well, the first goal is to capture the entire Islamic world and make it true Islam, which is the Shia Islam. And then after that, you will go. Yeah. I'm not sure if the Shias think that we were meant to capture the entire world until the Imam Zaman comes, right? The Imam Mahdi comes. You unify the Islamic world, and then wait for Imam Mahdi. But I mean, in Iran, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, the foreign portion of that is called Quds, which means Jerusalem. So they're named after their final destination, and that's why, I mean, this whole idea of, you know, spreading, Iran has that in their government agenda, and this is based on religion. It's not based on politics. This is all based on their understanding of what they're supposed to do to be ready for Mahdi when he comes back, the 12 Imam. Yeah.
And one last thing to add is that I was in the hippy dippy Muslim experience that I had. I like saying that, hippy dippy Muslim. Anyway, we had the what I'll just say is that jihad is not holy war; it's an internal struggle. The truth, and I used to joke about it. I'm like, oh, okay, it's not a holy war. It's an internal struggle. It's like constipation. But that was always my line. But the thing was that when we actually read it, when I actually read the scripture, I realized that's it's actually both to some extent. But when you say jihad to most Muslims, even those who are unwilling to wage it, pretty familiar with the idea that it means holy war in case you're attacked. That's the apologist view, that in case you're attacked. But then again, the idea of what does it mean when you're being attacked? Someone drawing a cartoon of Muhammad can be an attack.
I'm still stuck on, this is the first time I've heard that Army Navabi has had combat training of any kind. And so now I'm running the scenario, like if he and I were in Thunderdome together, like it was mano a mano, like me versus Armin, you think I could take him? Do I have a chance, or could he kill me with his pinky finger? You know, and I don't know. I mean, like, I've watched old Star Trek, right? You know, I've seen the you know, I've heard the danger music and seen Kirk, you know, fight it out. So I might have some Kirk moves I could use on him. But, you know, when they perfect virtual reality, Armin, you and me, we'll get together, duke it out, and then we'll go have a beer afterwards and see who survived the day. That work okay for you?
Yeah, I think that could be an amazing episode. We could have that as a...
See, if you and I were in the church, we'd say, and we'll do it in love. Okay. I'm doing this with the love of the Lord like a brother. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the culture we live in. There's a lot of light out there, you know, on social media, but there's also a lot of heat. And everybody just seems to be pounding a drum of outrage about pretty much everything, sometimes justifiably so, and I have to say that at the front end. But Yasmin, I'll start with you. Talk to me about some of what you're seeing out there. And we're seeing a lot of people who are just full volume, full tilt. I don't know. Are you, for example, you're buddies with Dave Rubin, right?
Yeah, we all are.
Right. But you are not allowed on Twitter in many circles to be friends with Dave Rubin because Dave holds some somewhat unfortunate opinions here and there in the eyes of many, including me. What's your take on some of what you've heard and seen out there when this stuff comes to light?
Well, I mean, it depends who you're speaking to, right? So you're going to have different groups getting angry at you for being friends or associating with different people, depending on who the individual is, right? So at the end of the day, I'm not concerned about what random people on Twitter, what their feelings are about who I associate with. Like, it's not going to concern me. So the same thing happens with sometimes people get angry that I'm going for, like, Ali and I are going to be going to Australia and New Zealand to speak about Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz's book, because I'm in the Future of Tolerance, and they were, Jay Shapiro made a documentary about it. So most of the hate that I've been getting lately is, how could you be hanging out with a Muslim and talking about Islam being tolerant? Don't you know that it's, you know, evil cults, blah, blah, blah.
And that Sam Harris is an Islamophobe and all of those narratives.
Yeah. So I'm getting it all the time from all sorts of different people, getting angry that I'm associating with different people. And it's, you know, just like in my life, I'm not going to be concerned about what random strangers feel about who I am associating with. I'm not going to be concerned on Twitter, even less so, actually.
You remind me, there was it's a poster. It's actually, it's made to look like embroidery. I don't know if it is or not. And it says, "Behold the field in which I grow my fucks."
Yes.
And see that it is barren.
Exactly. That's exactly it. That's the only attitude you can have. I mean, who are these people? If they're asking me valid questions, or, you know, they have valid concerns, then that's obviously something that I might entertain. But if they're just coming at it with hate because they personally don't like one person or another, I don't care.
Ali Rizvi, you want to jump in? You got any comments or thoughts on this?
Yeah, like, I mean, there are a lot of people who I have problems with in terms of, you know, their views. I've had, you know, online feuds. I enjoy them. I think they're a lot of fun. But a lot of people I have online feuds with, the people who support them are my friends. Like, I'm very good friends with people who support people who I don't support. And I think that's fine. And, you know, when you have an argument, you have an open argument, you go out and you call that out, you say what you want to say. And online is just it's a weird place, because for me, it's, you know, I have most of my life is offline. So, you know, I have a family, I have a baby, I play music, there's all these other things. So, you know, you go online, you do your thing, you know, you have a little bit of a conversation, then you go back to life, then you come back on, you realize that there were all these people the last 3 hours who have just, you know, lost their shit, in a sense, based on what you said. And you're like, oh, okay. So it's, I actually enjoy it. I have a lot of fun.
You enjoy the white noise of just high volume outrage and insanity out there.
You know what? The thing is, I don't know who said it, but they said that if you amplify everything, you hear nothing. And I, oh man, I don't know. I think it was probably John Stewart who said it.
It was the same guy who said, "Behold the field in which I grow." No, never mind.
Yeah, I know. It's the same guy. Quote. So, you know, there is, we all know. I mean, all of us are very different. We all have, I was going to say God knows, but maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, or she, or it, or never mind. The point is that all three of us who are speaking to you right now, and also Faisal, we all have strong disagreements about a lot of things. There are some people that, you know, I like a lot that the other three don't, or two of them don't. There are other people that, you know, we all have different political ideas. And that's a good thing. You know, that's a great thing. I mean, we're still friends.
That's not allowed. No. You cannot be friends. You must be mortal enemies. And you must say kind things to their face before you go write an evil blog article about them.
And you must agree 100% with every single thing that every friend of yours believes or has to say. Otherwise, you can't be friends.
All right. And a lot of this is actually guilt by association, by association, by association. So there's, for instance, you know, Dave Rubin interviewed a guy that I don't like. So now, because Dave's associated with that, we can't like Dave. And now there's somebody else who likes Dave. Now we can't associate with him because he associates with Dave. And there's somebody else who's supporting the guy. He's like, "Hey, listen, the guy likes Dave. So why can't you just disagree?" He's like, "Oh, now you're supporting the guy who supports Dave. Okay, now we can't be friends."
It's junior high. I get so frustrated by it all. Like Dave Rubin, to me, there are some opinions that he holds. I just think the way he talks about the left, I find reckless and hugely unproductive. And I think he way overgeneralizes. But beyond all of that, would I like to sit down in a room with a guy? Absolutely. Would I go have a beer with a guy? Absolutely. Does he seem like a genuinely nice guy?
But even if he wasn't a great guy, I tell people that if there was a Nazi channel or if there was an ISIS channel and they invited me, I would go. I would go because we need to have conversations, not with great people, not with good, just good people. We need to be able to have conversations with even the people that we find, you know, the worst of people. I mean, what's the point of activism is to change opinions. If you can't reach out to people that you have the strongest disagreement, what are we doing here? Like, what's the point? We can't make agreements a condition for talking to people. We already made agreements apparently a condition for getting along. So if that's the standard, we're making agreements a condition. Now we're making agreements a condition for even reaching out. For reaching out to people that the whole point of all of this was to get to people that had those strong opinions. Like, what, you're going to just go talk to moderate Muslims and tell them that... What? Tell them that they're good people, that they're already good people, you just believe in something bullshit. We want to be able to talk to people that are sending their children to get blown. We want to be able to talk to them. We want to be able to talk to people that think everybody that is not white is inferior. We want to find a way to be able to talk to them. Right.
And you learn from it too. So I'll tell you one of the conversations, the most insightful conversations that I ever had, probably ever in my life, was with a Taliban sympathizer after the Peshawar. In Peshawar is a city in Pakistan. They had a school there. The Taliban went and just shot dead 132 children between the ages of 12 and 14. They said Allahu Akbar before they shot them because they were the children of the Pakistani army. And they had a problem with the Pakistani army because they're trying to hunt down the Pakistani Taliban. So I talked to Taliban sympathizer after that, and he, if I had just said I'm never going to talk to the Taliban guy, right, then I would have never had this conversation. But he actually told me, he said that we don't think, if your faith is pure, you don't think death is an end. If you believe in an afterlife, then death is not death. It's just a transition.
I agree with that. I think where I was going with Ruben is, and I want to make this distinction, I'll get right to you, Yasmin, to make sure you have plenty of time. But my point is that he can be a good guy and you can disagree passionately about some very critical things and he can still be a good guy.
Well, we're going beyond that. We're saying he is a good guy and it's ridiculous for people to think that our disagreements that we mean that we can't get along with him.
You're bringing up examples of like Nazis and Taliban and whatever, but the point here is that our differences with Dave are not nearly as many as our similarities with Dave.
Yeah.
So we're not
comparing Dave to a Nazi or Taliban.
Yeah. No, I know that you guys are bringing extreme examples. I agree with your point. Yes, we should engage with people that we disagree with or that we have different ideas from or value systems or whatever, so that way we can learn from each other. And because that's the planet. If we're only going to talk to people that we agree with, then that's going to be a pretty sad state of affairs. Right. But Dave just recently had somebody on his show named Lubna, who's from Iraq, who's an atheist that had to go undercover, and she had to go away from her family, and she had to, you know, go in hiding for 2 years because of the death threats. And because of Dave's support, she was able to come to the U.S. and she's here now and she's safe. So that's just one out of many, many examples of things that Dave does that we all agree with and applaud and celebrate and are very, you know, grateful for. So he uses his platform for very positive ways. Now, some people disagree with some things that he does, and that's totally fine and valid. But I think that when we're weighing who our allies are going to be, it's important to weigh out how much more do we agree with them than do we disagree with them. So it brings me back to my Majid point again, when people are like, how are you going to be hanging around with Majid? Don't you know he's a Muslim and you're an ex-Muslim, et cetera, et cetera? Well, yeah, I am aware of that. And I'm also aware of the fact that Majid and I are completely aligned in our values. We both agree with secularism, humanism, liberalism, you know, women's rights, LGBT rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, we do have things that we disagree on, but we agree on much more.
Can I disagree? Yes. I hope Yasmin doesn't mind if I disagree with her a little bit. Because I actually think that even if I found somebody that I didn't find any agreements with, I'm going to be able to, you know, get along with them as long as they're nice people, even if I can't find any point of agreements, right? And the reason why I brought those examples of extreme examples is because the point that I was trying to make is that if the standards right now are so ridiculous that we can't talk to somebody like Dave, what the goals that we have with those extreme people, how far away we are from that, right? It's just, to me, it seems that the left right now is so sensitive about their right, and their sensitivity is so ridiculous, so that anybody even has a little bit sounds like they're right, they're untouchable. And the examples I give is like, I had a Muslim on Atheist Republic that he was defending killing gay people, he was defending killing ex-Muslim, he was defending wife beating, and he was defending having sex with 9-year-old girls. And nobody came and told me, why did you have this person on your show? Because he was a Muslim. But they tell me, why did you go to Rebel Media? Why did you talk to Dave? Right. But this Muslim, these are values that this Muslim was against, that the left was supposed to find. These are the values that the left is fighting. But because he's Muslim, nobody finds that questionable. But you have Dave on just a little bit. Oh, he's to the right. OK, no, that's untouchable. You can't talk.
Are you talking about two different things? I think you're speaking about, like, if we were to interview someone who was, we realized was someone who was completely against our values. And so you were bringing them on to expose those bad ideas, where Dave Rubin might be brought on as a friend and even an ally. So you're framing those discussions in slightly different ways. Is that fair, Yasmin?
Yes, definitely.
I'm sorry, Armin, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that if this is where the discussion is, where if we can talk to somebody like Dave, which is an honestly nice person, and even though we have disagreements with, we see as an ally and a friend, he's giving voice, he's pointing, highlighting ex-Muslims, which we need more of. If this is where the standard is, how far away we are from other people that we need to reach out to and be able to talk to.
Ali Rizvi, does this sort of tie into the whole Ayan Hirsi Ali thing? You know, she's tied in many ways to some more conservative circles, which have given her the support that she, from what I can understand, has often not found on the left, or at least fringes of the left, and for aligning with these conservative organizations. She's taken a lot of heat. She's been called a sellout and any number of other things. What's your take on Ayaan Hirsi Ali?
Well, I mean, we met her. Yaz and I were there. We spent a weekend with her in California. She's actually one of the most elegant and most inspiring people that I've met, even before I met her, with her books. And I disagree with her a lot. Plus, I get the most flack for being the regressive leftist because I tend to be more, kind of sick, so it's a nasty cough.
Aren't you a doctor? Like, can't you just, why aren't you hooked up to wires and tubes and shit? Like, you know, what's the matter with you? Don't you have access to these things?
Psychiatrists can never get divorced. Doctors can never get sick.
All right, forgive me. I interrupted you. You're a little under the weather. You're such a trooper to sort of press through. But in the circles that you're speaking about, you're considered way left to the point of being called regressive left?
Yeah, and I get that all the time. I also get Nazi, so I mean, and I get white supremacist. I've got a collection of great labels that, I enjoy.
They completely cancel each other out, too. I mean, let's put all these critics in the room and let them fight it out.
That's the idea, Seth. If you amplify everything, you hear nothing. It's a cesspool of idiocy, like a lot of the social media stuff. But anyway, getting back to Ayaan, I don't agree with a lot of things that she says, but I think just overall what she did at the time that she did, coming from the background that she did, nobody else was speaking out at the time. And she genuinely, I mean, when Theo van Gogh was murdered, his murderers stabbed him. They attached a note to him that had her name on it as a future target. She has been, like, she has actually lived this. She has a very, very real experience. She's come close to it. So a lot, and that doesn't mean that we have to necessarily agree with everything she says. Just on Saturday, I spoke at a libertarian conference with Students for Liberty, and people were telling me, a lot of my liberal friends, like, don't you know that they're funded by the Koch brothers? The answer was, everything you talk about is funded by someone or another that you don't like, but a lot of those people were conservative. A lot of them were Republicans, but I think that they have a lot to learn from the stuff that we all say. And when we talk to, if I talk to a right-wing audience or a conservative audience or libertarian audience, what I say based on what I think would challenge them and their worldview. If I talk to a left or liberal audience, them about the apologism and the hypocrisy that they have when it comes to Islam. If I talk to a right-wing hyper-Christian audience, you know, how singling out Islam is the only thing, I mean, when there are all religious fundamentalism is lunacy. I'll talk to them about that aspect more. So every group, every ideological group has a place that they can be challenged on. And what I try to do, and what I think all of us try to do, is leave everybody that we speak to a little bit uncomfortable. So they need to step out of the box. And you can't do that if you don't engage with them. You have to speak to them first.
Well, if you'd put all these rules in place, the late Christopher Hitchens would have never spoken from the stage at Prestonwood Baptist Church in Texas, where he was invited to do that debate. Oh, didn't you know it's funded by a church? He was like, I'm going to go and I'm going to try to defeat bad ideas with better ideas. And I'm also amazed at those who have not gone through the gauntlet, these armchair quarterbacks, you know, who didn't go through genital mutilation and didn't have to escape, a marriage, an arranged marriage, and do all the stuff that she did to get where she was. They sit back in their armchairs and start throwing trash in her direction. It's very easy to do on social media.
I 100% agree with you. And that's actually what I was going to say when Ali was finished talking, is I was going to say that nobody has walked in her shoes. Nobody can understand what her life has been like. I mean, even everything that I've been through, and I read her books and I'm like, I do not know where she got that strength from. And she has had some really low lows in her life. And probably the lowest low was when she had to leave Holland. And that was the time in her life when she started being viewed as more of a conservative person. And she has said many times over and over and over again, you know, I am a liberal and I have believe in liberal ideals. Please, if the liberals would support me, like that's, you know, that's the political party that she initially aligned herself with. But she was at the point in her life where she wasn't getting support from anywhere except for from this direction. And even though she was nervous and scared to take the support, she realized once she did that it was not nearly as scary and horrible as everybody had told her it was going to be. So, and I think that's what Dave talks about a lot too, is we assume that people on the right are going to be the antithesis of people on the left. And that's not necessarily so. Obviously there are people on the far right and on the far left that are polar opposites, but in the, you know, more center right or center left, there's a lot more agreement than disagreement going on. And of course, there's going to be racism across the board, or there's going to be, you know, xenophobia across the board. But when we're just talking about, you know, communicating with people and for somebody like Ayan to find an opportunity to work with people, you know, she found that with the conservatives, they were willing to listen to her and to give her a platform and to support her in a way that the liberals were not.
In just a second, I'm going to ask Yasmin Muhammad about her marriage and the escape from her marriage to a member of Al-Qaeda. How does that happen? What happened next? We're going to get into that next and a whole lot more. Hang on. For all the festivities and good cheer around the holidays, it can also be a bit overwhelming, especially if you're juggling, you know, Christmas gifts and the logistics of home and work and the ever-shrinking 2017 calendar. Well, Stamps.com is a fantastic solution for all of your personal and business mailings, bringing all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your own desktop, your own computer, your own printer. I just mailed off a few December bills. I use Stamps.com. I sent a Christmas gift to my buddy Corey in Dallas using Stamps.com. I just open the software up. I print the postage. Hugely fast and easy. Stamps.com lets you print U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any mail class on your own computer and printer. And the digital scale they send you means you're not going to waste money with excess postage you didn't need. Just fantastic stuff. It's a must-have for any busy homeowner or business owner who just doesn't have the time to waste. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer. An offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and that digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Seth Andrews. That's stamps.com. Enter Seth Andrews. Speaking here with three of the four hosts of the Secular Jihadist from the Middle East broadcast, I've got Armin Navabi, I've got Ali Rizvi, and Yasmin Muhammad. And I want to talk, Yasmin, if I can, about your escape from a marriage to a member of Al-Qaeda. Can you sort of walk us through that?
Okay, it's really hard to give a short version because so much went on. I mean, it's not an easy thing.
Well, the only reason I ask for the short version is because I know that Ali's on a time frame and I don't want to, you know,
it was an opportunity for me to plug my book, Seth.
Oh, please. I know that your book covers this more in depth when it does release eventually, but can you give us sort of a teaser? All right, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was married to him. I was forced into a marriage with him because my family thought that he was such a good Muslim, he was such a good man that he actually devoted his life to jihad, to fighting the infidels. And he was in Afghanistan working with bin Laden to that end. So, you know, what could be a better person to get their daughter to marry? And it wasn't until I was a few years into the marriage and had a baby that I learned that he was a member of Al-Qaeda. And once I learned that, it was from the Canadian CIA, the CSIS they're called over here. They informed me of who he was. And I really wanted to get my daughter out of that house, because at that point I realized she is going to end up having a life even worse than the life I had, which was unfathomable to me. He was already talking about taking her to Egypt to get her cut. And I needed to get her out of that house. And so needing to save my daughter is what propelled me, is what gave me the courage. And I didn't have the courage right away, but eventually I got it through a series of events that happened. And I got away from him and I stayed with my mom for a while until I found out that he was in prison in Egypt. Again, CSIS contacted me with a photograph of him behind bars. And once I realized that he was in prison, I felt safe enough to also escape from my mom's house. So I took my daughter, and it was her and I against the world, started going to university. And that's when I took a history of religions course. And that's when I discovered that this religion that I'd been following my whole life was a big lie. And the rest is history.
I think after listening to you and hearing how tough you are, I think you could kick Armin Nababi's ass. I mean, before he kicks my ass, I think you could take him.
I would never kick his ass.
Well, I think so too.
Can you guys tell me?
She does that every day on the podcast, every week.
I'm talking, by the way, here with the secular jihadist from the Middle East. I've got Armin Nababi, I've got Ali Rizvi and Yasmin Mohammed. Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar could not be with us because of a schedule conflict. The way you guys do the show, do you guys ever just hit a wall with each other? Like, no, you're wrong. And then there goes 2 hours as you hash it out. Does that ever happen?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, kind of like it when it happens.
I think Armin likes it more than the rest of
us.
You know, when I get angry and she's like shouting at me, I'm like, yes, tell me, this is great. Our audience are going to love this.
I think that there's a balance. It does get heated, and there are times when it gets heated. But I think that there has to be a balance where, you know, you have disagreements and people can benefit from hearing disagreements and different points of view. But one of the things that we've done, and some of the feedback that we've gotten, is about the inspirational aspect, you know, places where we do all align about our common experiences and people who find it inspirational. So in addition to the disagreeing,
part of the inspiration is that we take shit from nobody, including each other. I mean, you know, that's why I think a lot of us have our own following. And I think, like, the people, for example, that listen to our podcast because of when she's like not taking shit from us, that's why they come and listen to her, and that's why they love her, because we said something that she disagrees with, and she's not gonna tiptoe around our disagreement. She's gonna call it out, and she's gonna say why we're being fucking idiots, and our audience are are gonna cheer her on, and this is great.
I think all ex-Muslims in general, I think all ex-Muslims, I can probably say, have strong personalities, because it is very difficult to be an ex-Muslim, to make that decision and to have to, you know, deal with the consequences of making that decision. You have to be a tough person. So I think that it would be, you know, it's cool that we're all disagreeing with things and fighting about things. And I think that it would be pretty boring if we were all pretty passive, introverted people just agreeing with each other all the time, but that would never happen with any four ex-Muslims, I don't think.
Let's, there's a phrase that I like. I call it positive conflict. The difference between name calling and shit throwing and just toxic vitriol. but positive conflict. You know, let's be even passionately arguing our position, but you know, let's seek a good faith sort of, if not resolution, at least a better understanding of our, you know, presenting our opinions, our positions, our evidence, and then listening in return, positive conflict. Does that resonate with anybody?
Yeah, I think the difference between those two is that are you here in this discussion to win?
Yeah.
Or are you here to make a difference, right? Like, are you here to change opinions or maybe learn? Or are you here just to prove that you defeated other people and you just came out as the winner?
No, win. I'm kidding. No, I totally see your point. I want to come back to you, Armin Navabi, real fast. The whole Ayaan Hirsi Ali thing, I know we sort of skipped over you, the Majid Nawaz thing. Did you want to jump in on any of that? Do you have a perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I've been getting a lot of shit recently for being speaking a lot against the reform movement. And a lot of people think that you can't recognize the contribution that reformers do while also disagreeing with their with their views on Islam. I mean, for example, when I read Ayaan's latest book, The Heretic, I was very, very disappointed. And I thought, like, she's making suggestions that are actually, to be fair, ridiculous. The reform suggestions that she was making was very out of touch, things that would never happen in Islam. But me pointing that out doesn't mean that I don't recognize that a lot of girls have not went through FGM because of Ayaan, right? Or for example, with Majid, I don't know how many people he has convinced to have a different, like, have a reformed view of Islam, and I don't think his methods work. I really don't understand why he's kind of suggesting that we need to hold on to a book that is suggesting that you could beat your wife, or suggesting that you could have slaves, or suggesting that you could kill unbelievers, or that unbelievers were going to be tortured forever. I don't understand that. I don't understand why anybody would defend such a book, or a person that had raped a 9-year-old. Why would you defend somebody like that? But at the same time, Majid is fighting a law firm that is silencing people. And if he wins, it's good for all of us. And I just recently made Majid angry a little bit on Twitter, and he replied to me. He's like, I'm your ally. Why are you sniping at me? And I don't understand. These two things are not separate. You can disagree with your allies. You could point to their tweets or to their quotes and be like, well, I don't agree with that. I think that's ridiculous. And you could support them at the same time. These people are like, why come to me and like, why are you not supporting these people? These people are achieving the same thing. How is me pointing or all of us pointing our disagreements with people has to mean that we're not going to support the valuable things that they're doing? I don't see a contradiction between those two.
All of these things, like when we talk about reform or the Enlightenment, nobody really retrospective terms. We look back at what happened and we're like, okay, that was reform. You had a lot of people who are on polar opposite sides engaging in dialogue, and with the result is what happened somewhere in the middle. That's how it came about. It's a byproduct. Nobody went out the middle ground. The middle ground is always a byproduct, and it only happens when you have coming together. And I think that is the most important thing, is as people who are ex-Muslims, I mean, this is a privilege that we did not have growing up. Really butt heads and argue openly and disagree, and sometimes disagree very passionately. And now, you know, we're doing it and we talk to each other. And I don't take it for granted at all for a single day. I think it's, and then the fact that there are so many, you know, when this started out and there was Ayaan Hirsi Ali and Salman Rushdie and just, you know, Maryam Namazi and a handful of other people, a lot of these, there were some differences, but there was a lot more unity in the ex-Muslim community. You remember the early days of this whole new atheist movement, you know, for lack of a better term. And everybody was kind of, it was one nice, happy group. But later on, when payments and people go off in different directions and you have factions, that's actually not a bad thing. It's a sign of growth. It's a symptom of a movement becoming really, really big for there to be ideological diversity within it. That means that it's gotten somewhere. It's a very, very positive sign.
Since we're edging toward the Christmas holiday, I have a video version of this podcast on YouTube. Yasmin, we have to talk about the sweater.
Do you like it?
It's red, it's white, it's green, it's... Oh, she's got an...
It's my ugly Christmas sweater.
So, do you do like the ex-Muslim Christmas? Do you like the holiday? From time to time, every year, I find myself addressing it. Like, how can you be an atheist and put up a Christmas tree and enjoy the Christmas season? It's got Christ in the title. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, Thursday has Thor in the title. January has Janus in the title. March has Mars in the title. You know, the holiday is what you make it.
The word goodbye comes from God be with you.
I didn't know that.
Oh, another one, another really fun one. The word bigot actually comes from by God, which has this French roots in very, very religious person. That's where the word bigot comes from. That's awesome. Look it up.
I'm Googling after the show.
Of course, there's a little bit of controversy and stuff, but that is pretty much what it is. So.
The whole point, one of the benefits of being an atheist is not to have stupid rules. Sometimes I say, oh, God, and people are like, oh, why are you saying God? You're not an atheist. And like, what I tell them is don't be so religious about your atheism.
I hear it, too. And somebody, I'll say, oh, my God, like as an expression. It's just an expression. And they'll just look at me like, how can you invoke the name of God? And for me, it's like, I'm not invoking a legitimate. When I see someone sneeze and the atheist in the room says, you shouldn't say bless you, which is just a reflex. I think, are these the battles that we as activists have been reduced? Is this what we want to argue about? Do we want to be this petty?
Or when somebody says, I'll pray for you, and you're like, no, please don't. Save your fairy tales. I'm not interested.
Yeah.
If they're simply saying it as a gesture of compassion because they were trained by family and culture to do so, many of them are victims in their own right, and they're trying to be kind, right? They're saying, look, you're in my prayers during a difficult moment. And you look back and go, well, you can just keep them. Who's in the wrong there, right?
Yeah. I have so many Muslims, when I start talking to them, they say, assalamu alaikum. I respond to them, alaikum assalam. Like, why not?
Say assalamu alaikum to people. Like,
just as long as you don't add the rest of it.
Yeah.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Whoa. Hey, look. Y'all are. I need translation.
Okay, I have to tell you, even the sneezing, Seth. You said sneezing. You say bless you. In like Muslim, in the Islamic world, this is how it goes. Somebody sneezes, and then he says alhamdulillah, and then somebody else has to say yarhamukallah, and then you have to respond yarhamni yarhamukallah.
Yeah.
So it's like this chorus anytime anybody sneezes.
Alhamdulillah means thank you, God. So there's do you know where that came from? That actually came from when God apparently created Adam, and he was just a lump of clay, and then he breathed life into him. The first thing Adam did was he sneezed, and the first thing he said was alhamdulillah, thank you, God. Huh. So that's where the whole thing comes from. And now you have, you know, that's what people say. But I want to say my basic rule for all this stuff is if there is a party, I'm there.
Right.
At my place, Alishba and I got a Christmas tree. You know, it's my baby's first Christmas. So we're going to do the Christmas. We did our Eid thing. We dressed her up. She got lots of money. You know, we'll do anything as long as it's party and there's food. We do the Ramadan feast too, because my mom always has really good food. My brother has really good food in this place. We fast. I always say I fast 3 times a day.
Fasting between meals. I think I could do that kind of fast. Yeah.
If I owe you $100, I give it to you in fives or tens. You know, what's the difference? Right. Yeah. So I as long as there is good food and there is family around and people that are well intentioned who don't want to chop my head off and who embrace me, and if there is a party,
yeah,
sneak some beer in. But, you got it. What the secularizing rituals is a first step.
There's actually a secret ex-Muslim group that they celebrate all the Islamic Eids and stuff, but they have only one rule. You have to bring all the traditional foods, but you have to somehow make it haram. you know, you have to put some bacon in it or somehow it has to be haram. Everything.
It's disgusting though. A lot of those innovations are terrible because it's just bacon biryani is not as good as anyway. But there are people. I have been to one of those parties too.
What is the story on the unclean food? Like, you know, I was doing book research for Sacred Cows on the Orthodox Jews. And by the time I finished, I was like, this is insanity. You know, you can eat this, but you can't eat this, and you can't eat that. And this has to be prepared only this way using this kind of milk. Oh, my God. After a while, it was just unbelievable.
The Jews started it. Like the all of the stuff.
I can't tell when you're kidding, Ali Rizvi. I can't tell when are you being serious?
This is real.
This is real. I really hope people can tell I'm kidding. But so a lot of this stuff that Islam got, the pigs bribed God. They said, yeah, they just told God, they're like, hey, listen, just whatever you do here, we'll do anything you want. Just keep them the fuck away from us.
They're like the cows on the Chick-fil-A billboards that say, eat more chicken.
That's right.
That's what the pigs are doing for Islam.
No, but the thing is, Muhammad, when he was starting Islam, he was copying Judaism because he thought that Jews are going to get convinced that they're the Messiah they're waiting for. He just didn't know that the Messiah they're waiting for was supposed to be an actual Jew. So he learned that later when he went to Medina. But he thought he could convince them. That's why initially they were praying towards Jerusalem instead of the Kaaba. But he was basically copying a lot of the rules, and this whole not eating bacon thing got copied as well, unfortunately.
Circumcision. I mean, a lot of the Judaism, when Muhammad's first wife was also his boss, and he was a merchant when he was 25, and she was a widow who was 40 years old, and she sent him to trade in Arabia. He used to go there, and a lot of the other merchants were Jewish, and there were many Christians, and he talked to them and he got a lot of their stories. So that's why, you know, a lot of the rules of the Old Testament they end up in Islam, from, you know, whether it's stoning adulterers to, you know, bacon being banned or the circumcision, whatever. And then Jesus and Mary and the Virgin Mary, all of those myths also end up. So this was, as Christopher Hitchens said, plagiarisms. The Quran, it's not as original. Unfortunately, it also combined the worst of both of those predecessors. So some became a lot. What made it is what made it so dangerous.
But there are some original parts, and the original parts are basically when Muhammad needed to get out of a difficult situation, he would just come up with, basically every time he was in a tough spot, a verse would come down and we're like, God, hey, it's not me, it's God, just, you know, you have to listen to it. Basically, when you read the Quran,
including
you
just have to read wives.
You have to read it as if you're reading Trump tweets. He's just basically reacting to the latest situation.
Read the Quran as you would read Trump.
That's a t-shirt. All right. So you guys do you guys do Christmas at your house?
Yeah. I mean, when I was single, I didn't do it, but now I'm married and my wife likes Christmas. So I guess we're doing Christmas.
So, I mean, where's your sweater? Is what I'm saying. I mean, look, Yasmin wore the sweater. She's dressed for the occasion. Ali Rizvi, well, you're under the weather. Maybe you're excused. Do you guys do like a big production for the kids and everything?
We do the gifts and the Christmas Eve and all the kids all get the gifts. And it's mainly since the kids came around, my nieces and nephews, that we do Christmas. It's all around us, and it's fairly, like, there really isn't much of a Jesus situation going on in modern Christmas. So, you know, do we enjoy? We actually used to do it. I mean, my sister, a lot of my other friends who are Muslim, parties and they have Christmas trees, and a lot of Muslims in Canada at least celebrate Christmas as well. Not the religious aspect of it, but once at least.
I always like those people who put the nativity scenes out in the front yard and they'll substitute the baby Jesus with another pop culture icon. Was it Top Gear? They have a stunt driver called the Stig, And so they took the Stig in his white fire suit with a white helmet and put a baby Stig instead of the baby Jesus in the manger. And Christians had a shit fit over it. They just lost their minds. My favorites are nativity scenes that are done up totally straight, except they substitute Jesus with something, some other pop culture icon, a superhero or something. So I don't know. It's my two cents. Any final thoughts as we approach the new year?
Well, yeah, I was going to say it's been, and I've said this often. I want to say this especially on this show, is that we've come a long way from in the last 30 years. You know, so since Salman Rushdie went underground for his blasphemy fatwa, but now there's a huge ex-Muslim community. Just this year, we had there was the biggest ex-Muslim conference in London that Maryam Namazi held. There was. We've got Atheist Republic, we've got our podcast, we've got all of Yaz's work, we've got Faisal's organization, we've got my book. There's in December, there's a group called Muslimish that is holding a conference that I'm speaking at right in Dearborn, Michigan, which is the largest percentage of Muslims, Muslim dense city in the United States. Right to the heart of it, and going to bring together questioning Muslims and ex-Muslims to have a conference over there. Armin has been part of the XMNA tour, the ex-Muslims of North America. They've had several pretty amazing events, different college campuses. The Ayaan Hirsi Ali Foundation is doing the same. I mean, this year has been amazing when it comes to bringing the ex-Muslim experience out into dialogue. And just a mainstream, not just the mainstream atheist community, but the mainstream community and the dialogue that's happening. So I think it's been great. That does not mean we should downplay the risks. We still need a lot of security at all these events. Security, a lot of Muslims are still in the closet. A lot of ex-Muslims are still in the closet. A lot of them find it too risky to speak out. We should always be mindful of those, especially who don't have the privilege of living in the West and who live in Muslim majority countries and aren't able to speak freely. So there's still a long way to go, but and a lot of ground this year. And I'm really proud of that. I'm really proud that we were all a part of it.
Ali's, I want to mention this, what Ali's saying about globally, this is very important because a lot of people keep saying that, oh, the atheist movement is dying. And I don't know what they're looking at because we are growing faster than ever globally. One thing I'm very happy about is that a lot of activists are having a more global focus. Ali had a global focus. Yasemin has this amazing project right now that she's reaching out to ex-Muslims that need psychological help or counseling, and she has an amazing fundraising for that, and she's talking to her. So that's, and also people like Seth Andrews are not shying away from talking about Islam, and this is so encouraging to see. A lot of people are not focusing on things that are just familiar in their surrounding. And one thing I'm going to actually do a shameless plug here as well. One thing we're doing in Atheist Republic is that we have this podcast called Atheist Republic Voicemails right now. And it basically is a podcast with no hosts, and anybody that goes to atheistrepublic.com, there's a green button that they could click on and they record their voice. And basically the podcast is just voicemails after voicemail from atheists all around the world. And basically, anybody listening could get an understanding of what an atheist in Indonesia, and one from Pakistan, and one from Bangladesh, and one from Philippines, and one from Mexico, and one from the United States. And just basically opinions from all around the world. And if anybody could go leave their voicemail there as well, or listen to it, that would be amazing. But yes, can you also mention how could people find your consulting project? Because that's something I'm really hopeful for.
Yeah, so if you go to my website, confessionsofanexmuslim.com, the GoFundMe is there. So I called the campaign Free Hearts, Free Minds, and I've partnered up with a ex-Muslim counselor who is living in the UK. So he actually was at this conference that you guys were talking about. He spoke in the same panel as Armin. And so I'm basically, all I'm doing is connecting him with people that contact me from all around the world. So it's very, very difficult as an ex-Muslim in an Islamic country because you cannot trust anybody. You cannot speak to anyone. And so they see us online and they feel like they can trust us. So I get messages all the time from people telling me about their relationship issues or their family issues and asking me all sorts of questions. And I do what I can to help, but I'm not a professional. And I start to feel like they need better support than just me giving them my, you know, my random views on things. And so that's why I started doing this. And it's going really well. So Jimmy had the first three people, ex-Muslims, one from India, one from Jordan, and one from the UAE. And he's just wrapping up with them now. And then hopefully we can send him three more afterwards if more people donate.
Is there a specific or different website for that?
So no, it's on my website, okay. confessionsofanexmuslim.com.
I feel like it's a time bomb waiting to go off. I feel like there's a huge underground. It's like watching all of these people who are underground in North Korea, you know, and they're watching American films that have been smuggled in and they're finding ways to communicate with the outside world. And I think they're waiting, hoping, aching, working for that moment where things will come to critical mass and they can finally speak out, get out, participate in, you know, a better world. And I really feel that in regard to the ex-Muslims. There are so many who are in cultures where they can't speak out, but they are so creative in finding ways to, you know, find a conduit to connect with someone else who can connect with someone else who can connect with someone else. And I think then all it takes is the right spark and the right wildfire at the right time, and everything changes. And I hope that happens in my lifetime.
I also want to, I kind of want to thank you. There's been a lot of, I think the mainstream atheist groups talked to some of them, and they seem to be, in the past, they seem to shy away from the ex-Muslim issue because many of them are sort of very liberal leaning and they find the whole, you know, the liberals are very sensitive about Islamophobia and all of these things. So you're coming out and you're actually helping this get out there and you're incorporating.
Well, I'm an Islamophobe. I mean, there's only one real explanation. And I would talk to Dave Rubin. So, I mean, what more proof do you need that I'm the worst person in the universe, right? I found that, you know, the Islamophobe question is pretty easy to answer. And, you know, it's frustrating to me. You know, it's like, is Christianity a race? No. Is Islam a race? No.
Done. End of discussion.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this is a pretty rudimentary question we can ask and answer and move on to the next one. But because it is being used as a shield by so many, and I know that you guys have spoken about it in the past, it's often a strategic shield. What makes me crazy is that many people, certainly not all, because many of the great criticisms and worthy criticisms I'm hearing are coming from the left, like we're all left. But, you know, there are some on the left who are so desperate to appear, quote unquote, progressive in a certain way that they're just terrified of looking like bigots. And they bought the lie that criticizing Islam is some form of bigotry. It makes me crazy. It must be triply so for you.
Well, I think that what you're saying is true, but I think that they're a minority. I think the mainstream left, so somebody like Ellen DeGeneres, for example, tweeting about the hijab Barbie and saying how cool it is and how fantastic it is and diversity is wonderful and all that shit. That's pretty heartbreaking. That's pretty maddening, not just saddening, that somebody like her would be so incredibly misinformed. I mean, she would never be excited about a Barbie that was like a little nun Barbie or a little Jewish woman Barbie with her head shaved that comes with, you know, wig sold separately.
Hasidic.
You know, a Hasidic Jew. Right. Or about a
KKK Barbie.
Or a KKK Barbie or a Barbie in Mormon underwear. Nobody would celebrate any of these things, you know, ideologies or religions that she would never. But when it comes to Muslims or when it comes to Islam, it's like, oh, yay, how fantastic. She's, you know, this Barbie is a wonderful symbol of misogyny and modesty culture in religion.
I think you're right in that way. I mean, you're talking, I perhaps was being more narrow. I was thinking about activist, atheist activist, critics of Islam on the left. But you're right. I mean, the Ben Affleck crowd is loud and proud and blissfully unaware of how ridiculous the argument. It's gross. It's racist. And I'm like, it's not remotely racist. And this is an easy question to answer for anybody, I think, who's either not gleefully ignorant or they're not desperate to misrepresent because they want to appear progressive.
But globally, the left is still the champions of free speech and secularism and free thought. Globally, the left is fighting the religious far right, which is Islam. And this
which is
what
why it doesn't make any sense that they're so different. Sense
because the left in Western countries are basically on the side of the far right in Islamic countries.
Yes.
Ali Rizvi, author of The Atheist Muslim. I will link to your book in the description box of this podcast. I was going to say, you know, go take some meds, but you're the physician. So, you know, I don't know. You know better than I do what you need, my friend, you know.
It's a virus. My immune system will duke it out with it. I'll just take some. I'm just on Tylenol, so I should be okay.
Armin Navabi, he is the founder of AtheistRepublic.com. You have a podcast of your own, correct? Or do you just do short form videos? I've seen you out there quite a bit on social media.
Oh yeah, I mean, I just on Twitter @ArminNavabi. So @ArminNavabi is my handle. I sometimes just record myself 2 minute videos and I just put it up there and see what people how people are attacking it. It's just a good way to practice before a speech. Just see what people react to something before I actually.
Now you're a good communicator, and you make a major difference. You are part of the changing of the game out there. Thanks for everything you do.
Thank you.
Yasmin Muhammad of Confessions of an Ex-Muslim. You inspire me. Your story inspires me. You're just awesome, and you get me in the Christmas spirit with the big
thank you.
Christmas sweater. I hope you and all of you have a wonderful holiday. I hope you and your families have a tremendous new year. And we'll keep kicking for better things in 2018, okay?
Okay.
Sounds great.
Thank you, Seth.
Thank you for having us, Seth. It's an honor to be here.
Thanks again, Seth. We really enjoyed the discussion, and hopefully we'll be back soon.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.